Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and it's nice to have you with us today. We're going to find out about how cacao and green tea can help slash heart disease death by 40%. That's according to a major study at Wageningen University in the Netherlands. But we have a lot more to talk about on health and healing. Then, continuing with our series that will probably be broadcasting over the next 20 days, we're looking at debt, poverty, not just amongst the traditional poor, but how you can have two jobs, be earning $100,000, $150,000, and still it's not enough to maintain any quality of life. How do we get here? We're looking at the millennials, trying to help them. I'm sure most of us have met people who are just, they're unprepared for the real world. And I think that we have an obligation to help as best we can and as open as a person might be for the input of those of us who've come before them, have had our own trials and tribulations, and want to share what they might do so that they don't fall into the same pitfalls we do. So that is going to be today. Also, right after health and nutrition, I'm going to play a clip of two of the most respected National Security Agency employees in its history. In fact, William Binney, who was the top person at the agency in all of its systems. But they say something interesting that the mainstream media has not touched upon. In fact, I believe dare not touch upon. But we will, and we'll explain why that's important to you. So you see, we have a lot to share. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing. Long-term consumption of epicatechin, that's epicatechin, epicatechin, that's a compound in apples, in onions, in green tea, and chocolate, cacao. It can significantly boost heart health and reduce the risk of heart-related death, according to this new study out of the Netherlands. And that's, look, anything that can help us live a longer life, that's important. And what they did, they followed a group in what is called the Zutphen Elderly Study for 25 years and asked, how can we lower these people's risk of dying? And they found there was a 38% lower risk of dying from coronary heart disease than men with the lowest average intake of these nutrients found in common foods. Now, these nutrients then become what are known as functional nutrients, meaning they function inside the body to prevent something bad from happening. And that's important. Now, another study from the University of California, Berkeley, showed that copper is essential for burning fat. You don't need much copper. 1 to 2 milligrams is more than enough. But in copper deficiency is contributing to the obesity epidemic. And you can get it from beans and nuts. They're good sources of copper. Or you can just take a supplement with 1 to 2 milligrams of copper. But it actually boosts our metabolism to burn fat. This was done at the University of California, Berkeley, the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, and the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. They now have clarified the critical role that copper plays in nutrition. And it helps what are called the adipocytes and moving fat out of fat cells and into the bloodstream for use as energy. So without copper, or enough copper, fat builds up in your fat cells without being utilized. And that leads to, well, obesity. This was published in Nature Chemical Biology publication. Then we now know that those who drink green tea and who consume the green bean, the organic natural coffee bean, are getting the chemicals in there, the antioxidants, and that allows them to have longer telomeres. Telo, T-E-L-O, MERS, M-E-R-E-S, telomeres, are the end caps of chromosomes. Now, this is according to the National Cancer Institute, published in the Journal of Nutrition. And it reveals that women who drink these beverages have longer white blood cell telomeres, protective caps at the end of chromosomes, whose length is considered to be a biomarker of aging. The shorter they are, then the greater risk of coronary vascular disease and other related, age-related conditions. The longer they are, the longer you're going to live. So this is important. They studied 4,780 participants in the Nurses' Health Study, and that's been going on for, 45 years, and that's what they found. Also from China Agricultural University, C. buckthorn, B-U-C-K-T-H-O-R-N, compound, shows eye health support. And the proanthocyanidins from C. buckthorn seeds can protect the retinas from harmful light effects. And this is important for people who want to improve their vision. Now, C. buckthorn you can get most health food stores. And it's rich in the omega-7 fatty acids. It has vitamin A and K and E and C and B1, B2. And it's really very healthy. And it's used in other cultures on a regular basis, just not used in our culture. Also, for those of you who have migraines, and a lot of people do, according to Cincinnati's Children's Hospital, many migraines are due to vitamin deficiencies, mainly deficiencies of vitamin D, riboflavin, and coenzyme Q10. So look at your vitamins, especially vitamin B1, B2, and B6. If you have 25 milligrams of each of those, then you're going to have better mental control, a better brain chemistry, and coenzyme Q10. We need these for producing energy and for cell growth and maintenance. But when we're deficient, that can cause migraines. So, again, easy to deal with. Also, from the University of Kent, which is in the United Kingdom, comes a study about young people with older friends, and that can help reduce ageism. Ageism is epidemic. In fact, one scientist, I believe down at the University of Texas, sent out thousands of resumes. And in the resumes, these were all false resumes, but they listed the age of graduating from college and high school as in the 1960s and 70s. But then they gave the same identical resume with people graduating in the 1990s. And over 40% of the people who responded to the younger people. And that's unfair. Right now, it's just about equal. We have as many baby boomers as we have millennials, about 83 to 84 million. Baby boomers, unfortunately, are one of the first generations in American history that worked a long and hard life and cannot just automatically assume they can retire and have everything covered with pensions and savings and Social Security for the future. Everywhere you look, you have baby boomers who are struggling. Now, when they lose a job, it's much more difficult for them to find another job back in the workplace. And we're not dealing with that in our society. I'll give it a good example of this. I'm filming a new film. I've been filming it for the last 3 years. And it's called Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? It's about the new type of poverty that we're seeing, loaded with debt, at one time gainfully employed, and probably had a quality of life, a good standard of living. But the people didn't see what was coming in 2007 and 8, went through the Great Recession, and a lot of their jobs became redundant. Visas from foreign students coming out of India and South Korea, China, were willing to come to the United States, many with master's and PhDs, willing to work for $30,000 a year, where the person that they were replacing had maybe worked for 20 or 30 years and was making $150,000 to $200,000 plus benefits. These people were working with no benefits, and the people in these industries, and I actually heard a tape of a group of lawyers who represented companies that were hiring these visa students to come in, these visa applicants, I should say. And one of the selling points was, hey, you've got 20 people in your payroll who have seniority. They've been there for maybe 20, 30 years. You're paying them a lot of money plus benefits. Wouldn't it be better to save all that money when you can hire someone who's got just the same amount of skills, even more, and you're paying them one-third to one-fourth the amount of money? And that's what's happened. Plus, robotics has replaced a lot of jobs, and downsizing and outsourcing to other countries has replaced jobs. I remember I was told about a park where people who had cars could go into and they could at least spend the night in their car and not get a ticket or get hassled. So I went in the daytime, and there was it was a nice car, and there were four people, two teenage girls and a husband and wife, and they were cooking noodles on the radiator. That's really, that's something, if you've never seen it, kind of, you don't quite know what to say. And they were embarrassed. But I said, I'm doing a film, and it was called Poverty Inc., and I want to show this plight. I want to show your story. And they spoke with me, and they both had worked for NASA. They both were upper-level engineers. And when NASA started shutting down and his contracts ending, they got laid off. And he said he waited too long to try to find any kind of work. He thought he would find another job quickly because he had seniority. He was very knowledgeable. But nobody wanted to pay him $156,000 a year. They were paying people $50,000 or less. And he thought, well, this will change. And he found out all those other people who had been making similar amounts of money, they were all taking less. And he didn't want to change his lifestyle. And his teenage daughters didn't want to be isolated and stigmatized in school by being the ones whose parents are unemployed. So they kept up all the appearances of being employed. And they didn't stop spending. The daughters kept spending money like their parents were gainfully employed. And before, they were making $300,000 a year. How long do you think it takes to burn through your savings when you're not having any income whatsoever and you're spending everything you have? Until the day came when they had lost their home. Then the wife went out and started working cleaning homes, and she said it was extremely humiliating when one of the people that she went through this agency to clean their home was one of her former neighbors. And she said, how do you explain that? And he ended up working in a car wash, and that's where they were. So when we talk about what it means to be aging and there's a stigma against you just for your age, and then, of course, there are additional stigmas depending upon your ethnicity, your religious background, you know, your social standing, all kinds of stigmas, and it shouldn't exist. So what this University of Kent study is showing, that young people are less likely to be ageist when their friends have friendships with older adults. And even when young adults have no social contact with older adults in their everyday life, if they are aware of a friend who is friends with an older adult, this can increase their positive attitudes towards older adults as a whole. That's important. This was published in the British Journal of Social Psychology. Also, people should be using tocotrienols. Toco, T-O-C-O, tri, T-R-I, enols, E-N-O-L-S. They're part of the fraction of vitamin E. You have tocopherols, like alpha-tocopherol, beta-tocopherol, gamma-tocopherol, and you have tocotrienols. Well, this Georgia State University showed that the tocotrienols can help in the prevention and therapy of Alzheimer's. That's terrific because they're anti-inflammatory. And anything that's anti-inflammatory is going to help. And that's important. Also, mentioning vitamin E, from Purdue University comes a study that vitamin E metabolite inhibits pro-inflammatory enzymes and induces programmed cell death in human cancer cells, meaning in lay language that when you're taking vitamin E, it can cause cancer cells to die, which is a good thing. Also, the whole natural fiber works best to protect your gut and mucosal layer. And this is from the University of Michigan. So dietary fiber plays an important role in protecting the gut's mucosal layer. And it has long been known that the gut stays healthier and performs better with adequate fiber. But the question is why? Well, this is one of the questions that informed the research conducted by the professor of microbiology and immunology at the University of Michigan. And he says that the core of our research is we are interested in the physiology of the many bacteria that live in the gut. Well, simply stated, if you have a variety of different sources of fiber, if you have fiber from fruits, and you have fiber from grains, and fiber from nuts and seeds, sunflower seeds, pumpkin seeds, chia seeds, hemp seeds, and fiber from vegetables, fiber from starchy vegetables, fiber from legumes, then you're getting a wide variety of good bacteria. And all that good bacteria is good for you. And finally, from the University of Connecticut, walnuts alter your gut microbiome for the best. This is published in Cancer Prevention Research. So according to University of Connecticut, eating walnuts will change your gut bacteria in a way that suppresses colon cancer. How about that? That's terrific news. And that's the latest on Health and Healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to go directly into an audio discussion. And you have two of the most important whistleblowers in American history, both from the National Security Agency. And I'll explain what they're talking about and why it's so important we know this. At least this audience know it. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
I want to give you a little background on Bill and Kirk to set the stage. Because when I make the statement that I know of two people that have more expertise in surveillance systems in the world, that is not an overstatement. Here are their backgrounds. Bill Binney is a former highly placed intelligence official with the United States National Security Agency. Bill turned whistleblower, paid a huge price, and resigned on October 31st, 2001, after more than 30 years with the agency. He was a high-profile critic of his former employers during the George W. Bush administration. Bill continued to speak out during Barack Obama's presidency about the NSA's data collection policies, and continues to give interviews regarding his experiences and his views on interception of communication of American citizens by governmental agencies. Bill was a Russian specialist and worked in the operations side of intelligence, starting as an analyst and ending as technical director prior to becoming a geopolitical world technical director. In the 1990s, he co-founded a unit on automating signals intelligence with NSA research chief Dr. John Taggart. Bill's NSA career culminated as the technical leader for intelligence in 2001. Having expertise in intelligence analysis, traffic analysis, systems analysis, knowledge management, and mathematics, including set theory, number theory, and probability, Bill Binney has been described as one of the best analysts in NSA history. Now to Kirk. My mind, I got Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig here. I mean it. Kirk Wybie is a retired National Security Agency whistleblower who worked at the agency for over 32 years. During his tenure there, Kirk received the Director CIA's Meritorious Unit Award and the NSA's Meritorious Civilian Service Award, that agency's second highest distinction for work against foreign strategic weapons systems. Kirk Wybie, together with colleagues Bill Binney, Diane Rourke, and Ed Loomis, blew the whistle on NSA mismanagement and waste of billions of dollars in a complaint to the Department of Defense Inspector General. You can imagine how well that went over. Unable to stay at the NSA any longer in good conscience, Kirk, along with colleagues Bill Binney and Ed Loomis, retired in October 2001. Since retiring, Kirk has made several key public disclosures regarding NSA's massive surveillance program, subverting the U.S. Constitution. It's my honor to introduce my friends Bill Binney and Kirk Wybee. Bill and Kirk, welcome.
Thank you, Dave.
Okay, let's go right at it, guys. Hard and fast. That's how we work.
All right.
Mueller, his report. He just had an encore performance, his 10-minute, he was kind of sweating, looked kind of nervous, his 10-minute podium presentation. I'm not testifying, but let me tell you what's going on here. He started off his 10-minute presentation with the fact that this, I believe, false narrative that the Russians hacked into computer systems at the DNC, and it set off this cavalcade of situations where he had to investigate about the Trump colluding with the Russians about this hack. My question to both of you, am I wrong when I say that that's a false narrative, that in fact it was not a hack, that the information that was eventually obtained by WikiLeaks and published were not hacked from a hack event, but from a leak, an internal leak event? Bill and Kirk.
In fact, I don't call it a false. I call it a lie.
Okay.
Basic lie. Yes, they're making that lie up. And we can forensically prove that the published DNC emails by WikiLeaks were downloaded to a physical device and transported prior to them posting it. So that's what we can prove. And I have an affidavit in a court of law in the Roger Stone case stating that. And I'm prepared to testify in court to that and show the proof to it there in court.
Kirk?
Yeah, I agree exactly with what Bill has just said. Either Mueller and his people are not as sharp as public authorities say they are, or the agencies are lying. And I think the latter is true.
Yep.
And they're lying because why?
They don't want sources and methods revealed. They don't want things revealed that could incriminate themselves, information that they have. You know, there's a whole cloud of dust and a mystery behind this question. Who, if they were downloaded, these emails were downloaded to a storage device.
Yes.
Who did it?
Okay. Who do you believe
did
it?
How did they get over to the WikiLeaks? Who? That involves names like Seth Rich, possibly.
So people say that when...
I had one other reason.
Fire ahead, Bill.
The other reason is Mueller and the Democrats wanted to keep this issue going to 2020 election. Mm. They use it as an argument in the 2020 election. So they had to find a reason to do that, and Mueller was a part of that, making that reason, and so they could continue it.
Well, it worked pretty well in the 2018 midterms, right?
Yeah.
They got the House back.
That's right.
Yep.
Now, when you mention Seth Rich, people start outside that window in the People's Republic of Ann Arbor, where I live. You know, Dave, that's Seth Rich stuff. That's conspiracy theory. And the fact that Seth Rich would have downloaded that information and then got it to Julian Assange is beyond conspiracy theory. It's lunacy. What do you guys feel about it? You're the experts.
All right. Why is this important, what you just heard? Let me break it down for you. I have looked at this very carefully. I've also spoken with people like Ray McGovern, who was a top CIA analyst and was a part of the president's daily briefing, meaning he would take all the information that the top directors and department heads of the CIA collected, analyze them, and then give a brief on each one to the president's national security advisors. He is a member of a group. I'm not sure the total number. I believe that there were somewhere between 9 and 12 members of this group. They all come from the national security agencies, like the National Security Agency or the CIA, for example. And here's what they did. They took a look at the claims that the Russians had hacked Hillary Clinton's files and also had hacked the Democratic National Committee's files. But their expertise, which is second to none, especially William Binney, they said that it couldn't be possible. With the amount of information that was downloaded, there always is a track, or there's a second tier. There's what the public knows is being done or suspects is being done in the public interest to protect us. And then there are all these black ops, meaning a secret operation on a need-to-know basis that is occurring simultaneously where people in the agency generally are not even aware of it. And they do this because they don't want a trail. Because anything you enter into a computer, you've just created a trail. And these people know because they're the ones who created the system. So here's what they came up with. They said that it was not possible that the Russians hacked any of this. But instead, it was a former person working within the Democratic National Committee. And he was a Bernie Sanders supporter. And he saw how, from the inside, Hillary Clinton and Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the others were working, colluding to prevent Bernie Sanders from getting the nomination as the Democratic selection to run for president. And by the way, all the studies show that had Bernie Sanders ran against Donald Trump, he would have won handily. Now, then how did they get that information? How did they get thousands, tens of thousands of emails of Hillary Clinton? It came from a man named Seth Rich. Seth Rich was murdered. He was supposed to be robbed, but his jewelry was there, his watch, a ring, he had money. So that's nonsense that he was robbed. He was killed. But he had already handed off this information to the former ambassador to Great Britain, Minnie Murray, who confirmed that, yes, he received the information directly from Seth Rich in the university, I believe it was American University Park, right across from it. He then got it in the hands of Julian Assange. There was one other person who also participated. And that's why Julian Assange, right after the murder, for the first time in WikiLeaks history, offered a reward of some $20,000 for any information leading to this. Why would he offer $20,000 to a complete stranger? Well, because he wasn't a complete stranger. He was the one supplying the information to WikiLeaks. Now, if you look at all the different information that was released, for example, there were cables showing that Hillary Clinton was strong-arming allies around the world to take genetically engineered crops. She also was looking for dirt on anyone associated with the UN from every nation. They were trying to spy on everyone at the UN. Also, she had met on at least 40, I believe it was 44 separate occasions with different countries and getting them to sign on to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was done in secret, that would have destroyed American labor and unions. And she knew that. And that's why it was never to be open to the public, and its information was always to be opaque, never transparent. Those are just some of the things. Also, all of her behind-the-scenes dealing with Russia as far as getting nuclear materials to Russia. In return, the Clinton Foundation, I believe, received over $120 million. Plus, suddenly Bill Clinton got a $5 million lecture gig in Moscow. None of that would have happened without the Clintons and Mueller and Comey all being aware of it. None of that has been investigated. So here is what Binney is saying. Here's what other intelligence chiefs or people within the intelligence agency are saying, that we had a coup in the United States. we had a major coup. And we had the coup because the people who all supported Hillary Clinton, and I mean everybody supported Hillary Clinton, who was in power, the major corporations, the major media, all the major governmental agencies, the intelligence agencies, the military-industrial complex, big pharma, banking, agricultural, they all supported her because they knew that Bill and Hillary Clinton were the enablers of unmitigated greed. So they wanted her. And had she been elected, imagine the probabilities of what could have happened. Israel could have been given the go-ahead to go to start a nuclear conflict or major conflict with Iran. We would have had the complete destruction of Syria. We already saw what she did with Gaddafi in Libya and Honduras, the coup there, and the Ukrainian bringing the people in with a coup to bring the fascists and the neo-Nazis in. So we would be in a bad position, but the media wouldn't talk about it. It would seem like everything would be normal. Trump, they couldn't control. And as a result, they had to make sure that they disqualified him. And so they put together a dossier, and it was called the Steele dossier. And Steele was this former British intelligence agent. Now, he was being paid by the FBI. He was being paid by a Fusion GPS, which was a Fusion, which is a company that gets dirt on other companies or people, and by the Democratic people around Clinton. So he was making a lot of money to put together what amounted to a false dossier. It did not come from Russia. There was no collusion. But they had to make it seem like it did. So all their energy, all their effort, all their capital, as far as their credibility, was put into get rid of Trump. He was elected under false pretenses. And they were going to do this prior to the election. They wanted to get this dossier out. So Clapper and Brennan, the head of the CIA, Brennan and head of the National Security Agency, Clapper, got with other intelligence chiefs, and they all, 17 agencies, signed off, say, yes, there was probable collusion. But there was no collusion. None. None at all. And so who did they choose? They chose one of the political insiders. You see, if you understand that Washington, D.C., once you're an insider, once you've been shown by loyalty that you're going to protect those in positions of power and you're going to cooperate, it's not about Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal. It's about power and money. So this is why they never have to work outside of that circle. For example, where has Eric Holder worked? Where did the Clintons work? Where did they make their money? Mueller, where did he work? They all work for companies, law firms, consulting firms, military contractors. They all are guaranteed play ball, and you're going to have all that you want for the rest of your life. And that's how it works. And that's why it's so easy for people going to be a procurement officer at the Pentagon into making a huge salary working for a military-industrial contractor. And just in the military-industrial contracting field alone, there are over 200,000 contractors. So it's a big field with hundreds of billions of dollars a year being made just in that field. The same is true with the pharmaceutical industry. So when all these different industries want you as president, it's not because they like your personality or they like your politics. They like the fact that you are dependable and they're going to continue to make money because you're going to continue to guide the policymakers, the technocrats who run the agencies, and all the Council of Economic Advisors. All of these people are all part of it. The Free Enterprise Institute, the Business Roundtable, the Council on Foreign Relations, they're all aware of each other. And they could care less what your politics are. It's irrelevant. That's just a game that's played for the people. So they didn't work in their coup. They tried. They wasted almost 3 years instead of focusing on important policy that would help people. They did everything humanly possible to keep Trump from being elected, then to denigrate the people who voted for him, even though a lot of those were unionists and people who were card-carrying Democrats and liberals for decades who have been betrayed by Clintons and Obama. And so a lot of the people voted for him out of protest. But in any case, it was a coup. It was an illegal effort. It was sedition. And now it's coming undone. So Benny is telling us how it was not possible that the Russians did this. The people did this themselves. So we've been lied to, we've been manipulated. And that's why that's important you understand. Now, over the next month or two, my sources tell me we're going to start to see indictments, we're going to see people going before grand juries, and a lot of the people who've been the biggest mouthpieces out there are not. And historically, the liberals would never invite the former head of the CIA, the National Security Agency, or Homeland Security to be a commentator. They would be extremely biased. But that's exactly who they did. And also, there were a lot of crimes broken, a lot of crimes committed. For example, laws were broken, crimes were committed. For example, leaking information, classified information, Comey, that was Clapper, and that was Brennan, to the media. So they're all being targeted now for investigation. So we'll see all this unfold in the near future. That's why that was so important. Now, we're going to go from here right into another clip. And the clip we're going to play now deals with why so many Americans are in the middle class and have no savings at all. Please listen in.
Most American households did slightly better economically in 2015 than 2014, according to a recent survey by the Federal Reserve. 69% said they were living comfortably or doing okay, up from 65%. But 31% said they were either struggling to get by or just getting by, a figure that includes millions of middle-class Americans. In fact, it can be surprising to learn just which Americans continue to struggle. Judy Woodruff has the latest in our series with The Atlantic.
By almost any measure, Neil Gabler has led a successful life. He's published respected biographies of Walt Disney, Barbara Streisand, and Walter Winchell, written for leading newspapers and magazines, taught at prestigious universities. He's a husband and the father of two daughters, now launched in their own successful careers. He lives in New York's Long Island enclave, the Hamptons, a place of natural beauty and mecca for wealth and celebrity. And yet, for years, Neil Gabler harbored a dark secret.
It's very difficult. I'll tell you who it's really been difficult on is my wife.
Being the writer that he is, Gabler decided to come to terms with his secret by writing about it.
I never write about myself, so I didn't embark on this project saying, oh gosh, I can't wait to write about my own failures, which is basically what the article is about. But really, the spring of this piece was reading a news item about the Federal Reserve Household Economic Survey, in which they asked the question, if you had a $400 emergency, could you meet that emergency? And 47% of the respondents said that they couldn't meet that emergency without either having to borrow money or to sell something. And I read that item and I said to myself, well, who knew? But of course I knew, because many, many times in my life, and not just in the distant past, but in the unfortunate present, I couldn't afford those $400.
And that's the hard truth. Despite all his outward signs of success, Neil Gabler is frequently broke. His recent story in The Atlantic magazine brought widespread attention to that fact.
Did you hesitate at all about bearing your personal life?
Very much so. I'm not the kind of person who really likes to expose himself. But then that reluctance became part of the article itself, because I coined the term in the article, financial impotence. And it struck me that talking about our financial situation is very much like men not wanting to talk about sexual impotence. It's just not something you do. It's an embarrassment. It's a shame. It's a humiliation. And financial problems are exactly the same thing. So I thought, perhaps I can help those people who feel shamed and embarrassed and humiliated and show them, look it, I'm willing to do this. I'm willing to expose all of my faults, all of my mistakes, all of my failures. You're not alone.
What do you say, buddy? How's everything?
Hang it in there.
Gabler knew he wasn't alone even before writing the article due to weekly chats with Brian Brunges, an East Hampton butcher.
Brian the Butcher is my friend. He's a wonderful, easy guy to talk to. And gradually, over time, we'd talk about our financial situation. Very, very rare, particularly among men. And I remember one day, especially, this was one of those periods where I didn't have the $400. And unfortunately, they come all too frequently. And he said, I'm going to tell you something. He said, I've been in the same situation. I've got this expense and that expense. If anybody tells you that they're sailing through, they're lying.
Everybody struggles. I have a child with autism. He was diagnosed 20 years ago. Okay, my wife had to stop working. Became a one-income family. We accumulated a lot of outside expenses. So I struggled. But you know what? I got to do what I got to do.
That was almost the final push to write the piece. Because, you know, he's right. There are so many people in trouble. They won't talk about it. Brian is one of the very few who would be open with me, and I was able to be open with him as a result. So we were able to share this.
It kind of like took a weight off my shoulder, knowing that a guy like Neil, you know, he's got a house in East Hampton. You figure, you know, he's doing all right for himself. But he's not. Everybody's struggling, you know, and it's tough.
The middle class is in desperate straits. I think that's
Edward
sort of,
Wolf that's is a professor of economics
line.
At New York University.
Today, the average family has enough financial reserves to keep it going for about 3 weeks. That's it. And that's middle income. And if you go further down the ladder, basically the financial reserves can keep the family going for a couple of days at most. And so, you know, these financial reserves have just completely evaporated. It's incredible.
We came up with this word, financial fragility, when we thought of looking at the capacity of families to bear a shock, to face a shock.
Anne Maria Lusardi is an economist at George Washington University.
And the way we formulated the question is, how confident are you that you could come up with $2,000 if an unexpected need arose within the next month? And what we found is 40% of families could not come up with $2,000 in 30 days. So it's important to recognize that the financial fragility is just so widespread.
The main reason is that we've had a long period of wage stagnation in this country, even going further back, even to the mid-1970s. So in the face of stagnating incomes, what did families do? Well, for a while they did accumulate wealth, and this was buoyed by the housing price boom of going forward until 2006, and then suddenly the housing market collapsed, and so did net worth.
How much of what you would describe as your financial condition is due to decisions that Neil Gabler made, and how much of it is due to outside circumstances beyond your control?
That's a great question, and I want to take responsibility. I don't want to put everything off on these larger financial forces. And I chose to become a writer. This is the most financially perilous profession that one can possibly imagine, except possibly being an actor. You know, I chose to live in New York City because I thought I needed to be close to magazines and publishers that I needed for my writing career. So I did that. And New York is expensive. You know, I chose to have two children. You know, children are expensive. I made the choice to send them to expensive colleges. So those were all choices that I made that had serious financial consequences. But again, those choices were what I call life.
So many young people today are told, find your passion and follow it. It sounds like that's what you did.
That's exactly what I did. I followed my bliss, and I'm happy I did. So, you know, I accept responsibility. On the other hand, since roughly half of Americans are suffering the same sort of financial fragility I'm in, we can't say that they're all imbeciles. What we have to say is that there are forces beyond our control.
Let me ask you a couple of other questions about personal decisions you made.
Absolutely.
You brought it up yourself. The decision to live here, we're in East Hampton. Mm-hmm. People think, living in the Hamptons? That's a really expensive part of America.
You know, when people hear that I live in the Hamptons, the first thing they say to me is, oh my gosh, you live in the Hamptons. What they don't really understand is that there are two Hamptons. There are the people who live here full time, as I do, who are not wealthy. And there are the people who come here during the summer who are. So, yes, I do live in the Hamptons. And when I bought this house, you know, I could afford it. It wasn't exorbitantly expensive. I was able to afford it for a very long time.
This is all cedar, but you can see how many shingles are missing
right,
here.
Right, right.
These days, though, the house has fallen into disrepair. It's in desperate need of a new roof. Floorboards are rotting. It has not seen fresh paint in many years.
If I had $100,000, I could probably get it done.
Yeah. Did you ever think about moving to a less expensive part of the country?
We did, and we've talked about that. But here's the catch-22 of that. If we were, once the recession hit, you know, the house lost its value, as it did for, you know, most Americans. So now the house is deteriorating, it's lost its value. So if I had the resources to fix up the house to sell it, I wouldn't need to sell it. That's the catch-22. I am a financial illiterate, and financial illiterates pay a heavy price for their financial illiteracy.
Gabler is not using the term financial illiteracy loosely. It's a phenomenon economists say is a key factor in the current fragility of the middle class.
We measure financial literacy by looking at basic financial knowledge. We are experiencing much more complex financial markets, much more complex financial products than in the past. And the knowledge of people has not kept up.
Half of America will have to compromise on their dreams. There's one statistic that I cite in the piece from a USA Today survey, which I think is fascinating. And that survey determined that a middle-class existence in America would cost $130,000.
A year.
A year. The median income in America is somewhere around $50,000. So a middle-class existence was more than two times as great as the median income. And what that tells you is that the face of financial fragility is the face of the college-educated as well as those without a high school diploma.
So what did we just learn? We learned that people are struggling, including people making $100,000 a year and living in Los Angeles. Here are some of the takeaway messages that I've understood from this. Many people are not looking honestly at the jobs market. They're looking to assume that because they have an education or they have a background that it'll continue to be that way. But jobs are in rapid decline in drivers, small farmers, postal workers, manufacturing workers, electronic equipment assemblers, service jobs like fast food cooks and servers in restaurants and cashiers, fishermen, publishers and printers, newspaper reporters, delivery services, travel agents, telemarketers, sewing machine operators and garment and textile related jobs, data entry keyers, IT support, word processors, file clerks, and bookkeepers, and door-to-door salespeople or cold canvassing salespeople, and also decline in attorneys. So where are the jobs of the future? Medicine, including home health aides, physician's assistants, nurses, physical therapists, genetic counselors, occupational therapists, hospice specialists, also mental health field, social services, solar energy technicians, statisticians, robotic developers and service technicians, application software developers, information security analysts, computer systems analysts, aviation and drone pilots and dispatchers, 3D printing technicians, urban agricultural specialists, nanotechnology scientists, weather control engineers, teachers, blue-collar jobs in construction, electricians, plumbers, and carpenters, and masons. Those are the, not all of them by any means, but those are the places where jobs are in decline, and yet many of these young people are going to school today, or many older people are going back to school, and they shouldn't be going back to school because they assume if I just got a degree, well, the degree doesn't mean anything today, with over 50% of the young people graduating not having a job in the area where their education was. That's why I just gave you the places most likely to have a secure and growing future versus those that are in decline. And small businesses are declining like crazy. So the second lesson to learn is you got to be in the right place at the right time with the right idea and the right support system. And a lot of us thought as long as we're in a place and we've committed to show that we are good at what we do, then we should be able to live there as long as we want, including our whole lives. That's not going to happen in the future. Cities such as New York, Los Angeles, Vancouver, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Houston, Miami, Chicago, these are simply too expensive. In fact, a recent report showed that a one-bedroom, small apartment in New York rents for $2,980 a month. That's $20 less than $3,000 a month. Well, to pay $3,000 a month when you should not pay more than about 20 to 25% on rent or mortgage means you've got to be making well over $12,000 a year to afford this. That's the reality. And people are not. So they're living through their parents or they're having two or three people stay in an apartment, so they have no real privacy. And the apartments are getting smaller and smaller. In fact, in Hong Kong, it is so tight that they have whole buildings. And when you go in, it's really interesting. It looks like an iron lung. You know, you climb up a ladder, you open this little circular door and you climb inside and it's got lights. It's got a mattress. You can't get two people in it. It's just one person. And they're paying money to live that way because major industries are not sharing their profits with their employees. So even adjusting for inflation, wages have stagnated or gone backwards. And so everything goes to the bottom line and to the management and to the shareholders. It's not going to the workers. So ask yourself, isn't it time to move? There are many wonderful places in this country and around the world to move where you can have a better quality of life for less money. And one quick thing on this, I had a friend who was a school teacher in my hometown of Parkersburg, West Virginia, and he taught school for 20 years and retired. And about a year later, I get a letter from him. And in the letter, he is in Spain. He's living in a nice villa. He has a driver, a housekeeper, and a cook and a gardener off his pension. Not even Social, he was too young for Social Security. And he said that's what you can afford in that country at that time. And so when we ask ourselves, where are we living? How much more tightening the belt do we have to do? 51% of all the people living in Manhattan are living at or below the poverty line. So you have very rich and you have poor, and then you have your super rich. Recently, I went to a movie theater called the Landmark Theater. It's a nice theater. It's right on 57th Street, clear over by the West Side Highway. And it's small theaters. That's the future also, like 30 seats, 25 seats, tiny theaters. And they might have six of them. And this theater plays art films, you know, more intellectually challenging films, which are nice to see if you like those, and I do. But I noticed that the theater was empty. No matter what days I go, it's pretty empty. So I'd talk with the different people in the theater, and they were open and honest. They said, well, you know, we just don't have the business. And I said, why not? He said, because one of the guys said, go outside and look upstairs. It's 10 o'clock at night, and you see very little lights on in any of these modern big buildings. Go in and speak with the people at the front desk, and they'll tell you, yeah, we have zero occupancy. Every apartment sold. Where are the people? They bought them for investment. These are people from other countries that are hedging their bets on the future, and so they park their money into real estate in the United States in different places. And since there are a lot of wealthy people around the world, they believe America is the safest place. It's the most stable place. It still has the most freedoms. So they put it here. And then I was walking around with a buddy, and we're walking up and down the streets, block to block in Manhattan and on 12th Avenue. And from 72nd Street and West End Avenue, clear down to 22nd Street, it was just beautiful big buildings, whole complexes of buildings. And now you have the Hudson Yards, and you don't have a lot of lights on. Well, what it does is that immediately ups the price of everything else. So people that used to be able to afford rent can't. And you can't afford to rent these places. Most people wouldn't even rent them out anyhow. They're investments. And they're investments for the future. They're a hedge. So when you're up against this indomitable economic imbalance, where there's so much economic inequality, you have to ask, shouldn't we be changing? Shouldn't we look at a place that we can enjoy a quality of life, but still have a quality standard of living? Shouldn't we be buying a nice one of the smaller RVs and equip it with solar panels so we can drive anywhere without it costing us and enjoy the country, enjoy wonderful places? Shouldn't we have a plan B? Shouldn't we be able to live in a place with other people that are more progressive-minded? And that's what we should be doing. Otherwise, those people that you've seen in that, heard in that segment, especially the couple, they're just going to get stressed to the max. There's only so much human stress a person can take before it finally catapults into disease. So the idea that we should all be wanting to be in these urban metropolises where everything is cool and hip and that's where the culture is, that's not the reality for most people today. For about 70 million Americans, yeah, they can afford it. For everyone else, no. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone. How you feel, instead of out.